Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, commercial radio hits out at BBC Sounds. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when Kanye West made some more bold statements about master rights.
Yes, Kanye is still speaking out about the music industry and the record industry and record deals and big bad record companies. I think he's still going on Twitter. Everyone was very excited about him ranting about record deals for about 24 hours on Twitter. And I think quite quickly everyone got very bored. I think they are still being posted there, but there was a Billboard interview as well, wasn't there?
Yeah.
So he's still very much on the case, saying that record companies are evil, record deals are bad, and it's still, as we discussed last week at some length on the podcast, at the heart of all of this is the ownership of sound recording copyrights, what we often call master rights, and the fact that under traditional record deals, artists don't get to keep the master rights, the label gets the master rights, traditionally for life of copyright. He doesn't like that, and he is demanding that should stop, that everybody should get their all artists should get to keep their masters whenever they work with a label, is his line. Of course, as we discussed on last week's podcast, if you're starting out today and you're working with labels for the first time, there is a little bit more option out there, isn't there? There are different deals you can do with different sorts of companies, which, depending on how much commitment you want up front from your partner, may allow you to retain the master rights, or at the very least to get the master rights back after a period of time. So there is a lot more flexibility in the record industry today. But then there is also the issue of heritage artists who signed away their rights 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago, and whether or not they can get them back. And I don't know. I sort of sense that Kanye is saying not only should deals where artists get to keep their rights become the norm, which possibly they are going to do anyway, but also we should do something about all those artists who gave up their rights in deals 10 years ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's also the issue of, I mean, Kanye's been talking about all this, but Kanye is also a label owner. He owns Good Music, which is now a subsidiary of Universal Music. But through that company, he owns a portion of the master rights of quite a lot of artists, or at least he did.
Yes, aware that there was potentially a big, bold claim of hypocrisy going on there because of his JV with Universal and the fact that it owns the master rights of a bunch of the artists that it works with. Yeah, one of his bolder statements on Twitter this week was that he is going to give to all of the artists signed to Good Music the element of the master rights that he personally controls. So he basically said that was 50%. So presumably that means that Good Music is a 50-50 JV, so he has half of the rights himself. Universal has the other half, and he was basically saying, I am so adamant about this, I'm going to give all the Good Music artists the bit of the copyright back that I can control. So I guess we'll see whether or not that happens. Certainly some of those artists responded positively on Twitter, as you would. So maybe he will make good on that commitment. And so then he can say to Universal, not only do I preach this, I practice it too, you should follow my lead.
Yeah, we'll see. And I think we're still waiting to see what Universal ultimately makes of all this. I suspect that other 50% isn't coming back anytime soon to those artists. But I don't know, we'll see.
Maybe Kanye is the one person who can make this happen. Because although in the world of Kanye, this is a relatively new debate that's ongoing, in the wider artist community, this debate's been going on for quite some time. But maybe what we were waiting for was for Kanye West to step forward. Do you think all of this means he's pretty much given up on his presidential election campaign? It does feel like he spent pretty much the entirety of the last week ranting about, and I suppose to be fair, having meetings behind the scenes about the state of the music industry. Maybe he's kind of thinking, do you know what? There's nothing I can do about the United States of America, but maybe there is something I can do about the United States of the music industry.
Well, his presidential campaign always seemed flimsy at best. I mean, the fact that he can't even stand everywhere basically makes it impossible for him to become president. And it's not like you could not become president, but you could become a congressman of somewhere. I don't think that's how it works, is it?
That's not how it works. I think pretty much the only thing that he could achieve is he could screw everything up for Joe Biden and the Democrats. I think that is the one achievement that he could have in terms of his dabblings in the presidential elections in the US.
Well, there's that to look forward to.
But given that we spent quite a lot on last week's setlist talking about all things Kanye, you'll be pleased to hear that that is not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, later on we will be discussing YouTube's insistence that it can give or not give access to Content ID to whoever it wants. But first, UK media regulator Ofcom has said that it will allow a new 24/7 dance music channel within the BBC Sounds app to launch as planned. However, it is going to start looking at the BBC Sounds app as a whole in order to work out whether or not it is currently overstepping its public service remit and unfairly competing with commercial media.
Yes, so this was Ofcom specifically responding to a complaint, a formal complaint. Now, when you're a media regulator, you get an awful lot of complaints that you have to deal with. But this complaint specifically came from an MP in Parliament, a Tory MP called Andy Carter, who, amongst other things, is chair of a thing called the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Commercial Radio. So All-Party Parliamentary Groups, or APPGs, they're sort of informal committees within Parliament that both MPs and Lords can be members of. So they don't have any formal standing, any formal role, but they're ways for MPs and Lords, parliamentarians who have common interests, to come together and sometimes socialise and sometimes have discussions and debates around certain topics. There's loads of APPGs. Some of them are very serious, so they're based around Middle Eastern affairs or certain political ideologies. Others are, well, I mean, there are some APPGs for football club supporters, and there's a jazz appreciation APPG. There's an APPG for music as well. And although these are informal organisations, for certain industries and sectors, they are quite useful, actually, because they are a way of identifying who within Parliament is interested in what you do and therefore likely to be sympathetic towards what you do. So, for example, the APPG for music is an easy way for the music industry to say, oh, do you know what? All of those MPs and Lords over there are clearly music fans. They're interested in music making. They're interested in the music industry. So they're probably going to be allies. They're probably going to be people who will be supportive of whatever it is that we want government or politicians to support us on. So therefore, if you are chair of the APPG for commercial radio, that probably means that you are a fan of commercial radio, you're a supporter of commercial radio, you're likely to speak up for the commercial radio sector within Parliament and parliamentary debates. And so therefore, if you are a commercial radio station, it's quite useful that there's an APPG for commercial radio, because it means, okay, those are our allies within Westminster. And, you know, to what extent Andy Carter was outraged himself by the news that the BBC was adding a brand new dance music strand to the BBC Sounds app, or to what extent the commercial radio sector and their lobbyists reached out to him and said, this is an outrage, isn't it? But however it came about, this MP basically said that this new dance music service that the BBC has announced shouldn't be there. It doesn't serve any sort of public service remit. It's the BBC, the pesky BBC, overstepping its mark yet again.
Yeah, now we should probably do a little bit more background, because not everyone out there is going to know what the BBC Sounds app is, even, are they? Because, you know, not everyone who listens to this is in the UK. I mean, I assume they've all heard of the BBC. But basically, the BBC Sounds app is the BBC's audio app. In there, you can access, where you can listen live to all their radio stations. You can also listen to archived radio shows. You can listen to all the BBC's many podcasts, and the many podcasts it has launched since it launched the BBC Sounds app. And there are also various music things in there. There are music mixes in there that you can listen to. So it's kind of an all-round audio app. And there's various changes been made to it since it launched. The latest announcement was, as you say, that the BBC was going to add a 24/7 dance music channel to it, which will be, you know, it'll be dance music playing any time of the day or night that you would care to listen to it. It's not going to be new content. It's basically repurposing the BBC's various dance music radio shows and just putting them on a 24-hour loop. But just doing that has clearly got the backs up of the commercial radio sector.
Yeah, so, I mean, the BBC Sounds app has been slightly controversial in a number of different ways since it was first announced and then subsequently launched. I mean, firstly, there were plenty of BBC radio fans who thought that it was a backward step from the app it replaced, because there used to be an app called the BBC Radio Player. So if I remember rightly, originally, radio programmes were just in the main iPlayer alongside TV programmes. Then they made a separate radio player app for radio shows. And then ultimately, that got replaced by this all-singing, all-dancing new Sounds app. But some people didn't like it when it happened.
No, quite a few people, as you said, it was a backward step. And some thought it didn't have the same functionality as the iPlayer radio app. And other people said, well, I just want the radio. I don't want all these podcasts and mixes and all this other stuff that you've shoved in there complicating things. Just give me the radio. In fact, I mean, I think a lot of people said, why didn't you just keep one iPlayer app? Why did you have to split in two anyway? But, I mean, there's lots of... People just don't like change, do they? That's the big thing. That's the one... You could kind of boil it down to that main complaint, is that people don't like it when things change and things have a habit of changing.
Yeah, I guess a big part of it really was, I mean, people get used to apps, don't they? They get used to working out where the programs they like are or how you search for stuff. And then when it all changes overnight and you're forced to use a new version, people don't like it. So that was one of the controversies around the BBC Sounds app when it first launched. Then actually, in music circles, albeit a little bit more behind the scenes, there have been questions around, although at the core, the app is the BBC's radio stations streaming and then the radio programs on demand, which has actually been available for a long time in various different places. And as you say, a lot of the podcasts that are in there extra are more spoken word, the music podcasts. But there has been a debate within the music industry as the music element of BBC Sounds becomes more sophisticated and as they add mixes and they seem to have ambitions to be offering ever more innovative ways of accessing music. From a music industry perspective, you actually then get into some licensing questions. And these questions have been going on behind the scenes because ultimately the BBC Sounds app is still licensed through the UK music industry's bigger deal with the BBC at large, which is all done through the collective licensing system, through PPL on the recording side and PRS on the song, on the publishing side. And some people are saying, well, hang on a second, this no longer looks like a radio station. It now looks more like a music service. And so if it's a music service, well, A, should the BBC be getting into offering a music service? I mean, will it eventually almost move kind of into Spotify territory? And that's not really where the BBC should be. But I mean, even before that, you know, at one point does the music industry say, actually, this is no longer a sophisticated radio service. It's a music service. And so we no longer want to license this through the collective licensing system, through PPL. That then throws up loads of other questions, because when money goes through PPL, generally speaking, that money gets split 50-50 between artists and labels. So half goes to the copyright owner, usually a label, half goes to the performers who appear on the record, including the session musicians. And the minute labels start saying, as some of the majors have, as BBC Sounds gets more interactive, we think we should be doing direct deals with it rather than allowing it to flow through the collective licensing system. Then the question is, well, are you now saying that artists should get paid royalties like they do with Spotify, which is all subject to contract, or would artists still get their 50%? So there have been various controversies with the BBC Sounds app around listeners not liking it, some licensing issues in the music industry, but yeah. Today we're focusing on the commercial radio sector, which is always critical of anything that the BBC does, which the commercial stations think is treading on their territory. So generally speaking, commercial radio is happy for the BBC to do all of those plays and documentaries on Radio 4, because nobody really in the commercial radio space is ever going to do that sort of thing. They're happy for the BBC to have the specialist shows on Radio 1 and 1 Extra and 6 Music and Radio 2, because, if we're being honest, most commercial radio stations have pretty much given up, with a couple of very important exceptions, but in the main, a lot of commercial stations have pretty much given up on specialist shows. So with all of those things, generally commercial radio is like, yeah, the BBC should do that. But the minute they do anything which looks like it's kind of moving into Capital Radio or Heart or Kiss territory, that's when they start to get a little bit critical. And so I guess from a commercial radio perspective, offering a 24/7 dance music service, well, you could think that's kind of moving in the territory of a service like KISS, which is ultimately a dance electronic music radio station. So I think that was what the commercial radio sector was saying, was because BBC Sounds is not really regulated in the same way as the main BBC radio stations, I think because the regulators don't really understand BBC Sounds, whereas they understand Radio 1, 1 Extra, 6 Music, Radio 2. So what's happening on those main stations the regulators are keeping an eye on, whereas, well, this is certainly what commercial radio and this MP Andy Carter was saying, is they feel that the regulators aren't really scrutinising what's happening on the BBC Sounds app. So therefore, maybe, whether this is deliberately or by accident, the BBC is treading into commercial radio territory, which it shouldn't do, and it's only allowed to do that because the BBC Sounds app is not being scrutinised in the way that it is. I think that's where this story came from. We've got some statements from Andy Carter and from the commercial radio industry, so I guess maybe we can read those out and people can see whether or not they agree with our interpretation of what's going on here.
Yeah, so Andy Carter in his complaint to Ofcom said, "It's imperative for the future of the BBC that it provides high quality, distinctive content that warrants its significant licence fee income. I am concerned about the serious lack of transparency and scrutiny of the BBC Sounds platform. New services like Radio 1 Dance do not appear to meet the important public value tests that the BBC must observe. I hope Ofcom will conduct a thorough review of BBC Sounds as a matter of urgency." Meanwhile, the CEO of Radio Centre, which is the trade body that represents the commercial radio industry, also gave a statement where she noted that the BBC recently had a new boss, a new director general, Tim Davey, who made various comments about the future of the BBC and how he saw it developing under his leadership. She said, "We were encouraged to hear new director general Tim Davey emphasise that distinctiveness and true public service value should be at the heart of all BBC content. It is disappointing, therefore, to see this announcement of a new 24-hour dance stream. It is really difficult to understand what qualifies as distinctive in this offering. Commercial radio has a rich catalogue in this area and is very popular with audiences. We know the BBC is struggling to attract younger audiences, but launching in competition to existing UK-based providers who rely on advertising revenue rather than public funding is really not the way ahead. We agree that this is the time for an urgent review."
So some tough talking there from the commercial radio sector and from their supporter-in-chief in the Houses of Parliament. Has to be said that some of the real dance music fans, electronic music fans who were in my social feeds, who saw this statement and saw the CMU Daily report on this, I mean, they were quite disparaging of what the commercial radio sector was saying in that basically, okay, yes, there may be like Kiss radio type stations which have a dance bias, but they're playing very mainstream dance music, and you can't really compare the output of those stations with the output of the specialist shows on Radio 1, which are going to make up most of the content of this new service, which, as we've already said, isn't a brand new service. It's simply taking existing programmes and presenting them in a different place so that there's other ways that people can access it. So there was quite a lot of dance music fans in my feeds who weren't that impressed with the statement from the commercial radio industry or from the APPG for commercial radio, although I've not checked but I'm assuming that those people will be pleased with what Ofcom said, because Ofcom responded quite quickly to this. And as you said, I think at the start, although they did raise some questions about BBC Sounds at large, they said that there wasn't any issues despite what Radio Centre and the APPG had said specifically with this new dance music service.
Yeah, it said that having looked into the Radio 1 dance stream, which is set to launch early next month, that there wasn't further scrutiny required. The BBC did not need to conduct a public interest test before that launch because the new channel was just repurposing existing content and therefore wasn't a material change to existing services. However, it did say that Andy Carter was possibly right to say that there needed to be further scrutiny of the app as a whole and how it was developing. It said in a statement that there have been a number of incremental changes to BBC Sounds, and some stakeholders in the commercial radio sector have concerns about its development. Ofcom therefore intends to consider the market position of BBC Sounds through a public process, seeking evidence from stakeholders and the BBC.
Yeah, and it's interesting there that it's seeking evidence from the BBC itself, as well as the BBC's critics in Parliament, in the commercial radio sector and elsewhere. And that was very much implying that, as far as Ofcom can see, the BBC Sounds app has evolved quite a lot over the last year, but crucially, there are plans afoot to further evolve it in the future. And as I say, some of those debates have been ongoing in the music industry about how labels and publishers should license the service often the controversy isn't about the BBC Sounds app that is here now. It's about what people are hearing in terms of where BBC bosses would like to take the app next. So it feels like what Ofcom want to do as part of this review is to scrutinise not only what is now available through BBC Sounds and check whether or not that is definitely serving a public service, as the BBC is meant to do, but also get to the bottom of, OK, what's going to happen to BBC Sounds next month and in the next 12 months and the next 3 years? And of the innovations that are incoming, what of those are exactly the sorts of things that BBC should be doing, and which, if any, look like it's the BBC going head-to-head with commercial radio or indeed other music services, where maybe, given the privilege it enjoys through its licence fee funding and, of course, through the massive archive of content it's sitting on, maybe there's some plans that they have which they shouldn't really have.
So the review is expected to be completed by the end of the year, and I guess we'll come back to that when its findings on a later edition of Setlist. And finally, YouTube has hit back at a lawsuit arguing that it should not enjoy protection under the copyright safe harbour because it doesn't make its content ID rights management system available to everyone. YouTube says that the musician behind that legal action, Maria Schneider, does actually have access to content ID via a third party, and that the conduct of a company also involved in the lawsuit, called Pirate Monitor, shows exactly why YouTube has to be picky about who it grants access to.
Yeah, so this was a really interesting lawsuit when it was first filed, before we got the entertaining response from YouTube last week. And this whole case centres on what is, we have to say, a common gripe amongst the independent artist and songwriter community, and indeed some smaller independent labels and publishers. Because obviously YouTube has this thing called Content ID. Most of our listeners will be aware of what that is. It's YouTube's rights management system. So if you are a copyright owner, not just music, but let's look at it from a music perspective. You earn the rights in some music. You can log that music with Content ID. And then if anyone else uses your music in their video, in their user-generated content, then in theory, doesn't always work, but in theory, because you've logged the music with Content ID, the system will automatically spot that your music is in someone else's video. And then you can do one of two things, really. You can either ask to block that video, or you can monetize the video and say, okay, I'm happy for my music to appear in that video, but any ad income that is generated by that content, I want my cut of that money. And those are basically the two choices that you can do as a copyright owner. And you can either just have a fixed rule across the board, I always block or I always monetize, or some people do it on a case-by-case basis. So that's Content ID. It's YouTube's rights management system. And in some ways, it's an enhanced version of the takedown system that an internet platform has to have if it wants to avoid liability for content that's uploaded to its servers which infringes copyright. So this is the copyright safe harbor that we've talked endlessly about on the podcast. It sits in copyright law in the US, in Europe and elsewhere. And it's that bit of law that says, if you're an internet company and your customers, your users, use your platform, your servers, your networks to distribute content without license, you can't be held liable for that copyright infringement, because if you distribute content without license, that's copyright infringement. You, as the internet company, can't be held liable for that copyright infringement, providing you have a takedown system. So that the copyright owners, whose work is being distributed without license, can alert you to it, and then you're obliged to remove it. So that's a legal obligation. And to be fair to YouTube, Content ID takes that legal obligation and then ramps it up. Well, certainly a gear, and YouTube would argue several gears. The Content ID goes well beyond YouTube's legal obligations in this domain. But the key point about this lawsuit is, okay, maybe Content ID is a good system. I think it is. YouTube would say it was a brilliant system. Some people in the music industry might disagree. But however good Content ID may be for copyright owners, it's only good for those copyright owners who have access to it. And basically, there's certain criteria you have to meet before YouTube will allow you to use Content ID. And that criteria means that most independent artists and songwriters and smaller labels and publishers are not able to get access to it, which means if they want to remove content from YouTube, they have to do, again, one of two things. Either find someone who does have Content ID access and get them to do it on their behalf, or you can manually issue takedowns against YouTube like you would any other internet site claiming safe harbor protection. But the crucial thing in this lawsuit, by this musician, Maria Schneider. She was saying that the manual system for removing content off YouTube is inefficient and ineffective. And because YouTube isn't making Content ID available to everybody, it can't claim that it's Content ID that means it is meeting its safe harbor obligations. It's basically what Maria Schneider was claiming in her lawsuit.
So in its response, which was filed with the courts last week, YouTube started by explaining exactly why it doesn't make Content ID available to absolutely everybody. It said, Content ID empowers users to automatically or at the touch of a button remove content from YouTube or block it from appearing in the first place. The tools thus have the potential to be used improperly to censor videos that others have every right to post and share through YouTube. Further, it adds, the tools enable users to claim ownership rights in others' content and to siphon to themselves revenue that rightly belongs to others. Because of the potential for abuse of these scaled tools, YouTube limits access to them, seeking to ensure that those who use them will do so responsibly and will not cause harm to YouTube, its users, or to other copyright owners.
As for Maria Schneider's key claim that for those copyright owners who don't have access to Content ID and who have to use the manual system for issuing takedowns, that YouTube's takedown system isn't efficient or effective enough to get safe harbor protection. Needless to say, YouTube would strongly deny that. They would say, however it is that you're issuing takedowns to us, we are very much compliant with the law. They then stress again and again, Content ID isn't us just complying with the law. It goes way beyond what we are legally obliged to do. And then, I mean, as you alluded to, in terms of the specific complaints of Maria Schneider and then this company Pirate Monitor, who were the two main plaintiffs on this case, well, first of all, they said to Maria Schneider, you're saying you don't have access to Content ID, which on one level is true, but on another level, it's not true, because lots of music distributors have access to Content ID. So what lots of artists and songwriters and smaller labels and publishers do who don't have direct access is they find a distributor who does, and then they get the distributor to manage their music through Content ID. And Maria Schneider has done that. And basically what YouTube was saying is you have an agent who has Content ID access. They have been managing your content on our platform. They've been monetizing your content on our platform. And then they also said, not only that, but the agent you use has a license with us. They are licensing their catalog to us, which includes your music. So you can't even claim there was any copyright infringement on our platform because we have a license to use your music. Was the sneaky way that YouTube was trying to respond specifically to Maria Schneider's claims in the original lawsuit.
As for Pirate Monitor, YouTube is more scathing about its involvement in the lawsuit. YouTube's counterclaim makes various allegations about the conduct of the anti-piracy firm, concluding that that conduct demonstrates why Content ID access is not available to everyone. It accuses Pirate Monitor of setting up various anonymous accounts on YouTube, uploading snippets of films controlled by its clients, and then issuing takedown requests against those uploads. Pirate Monitor's serial uploads and DMC takedown requests for the same videos, says YouTube, were central to a scheme through which it hoped to gain access to YouTube's powerful copyright management tools, in particular Content ID.
Yeah, so basically what YouTube is alleging is that this company, Pirate Monitor, had requested access to Content ID. YouTube had said, we can't give it you. They explained the reasons that Andy just went through as to why they have to be careful with who they give Content ID access to. They then said, in order to get access, you need to do two things. You need to demonstrate. Everything is two things today, isn't it? you need to do two things. Although, this isn't a choice. My previous sets of two have been choices, either ors. You have to get both of these to qualify for Content ID, which is, one, you have to prove that you are managing a sufficient amount of rights, that your content is being used on YouTube a lot to warrant and justify getting access. Secondly, you have to prove that you are experienced at issuing takedowns and you understand the ins and outs of takedown rules, particularly under US copyright law. And so what YouTube is saying is, when they told this to Pirate Monitor, and they basically said, you don't have enough of your client's content on our platform, you don't have enough experience issuing takedowns to qualify, what Pirate Monitor allegedly did was they started uploading, through anonymous accounts, clips of content that they were representing on behalf of their clients, and then immediately issuing takedowns against that content in a bid to show two things. One, that there was lots of the content that they represent being unofficially uploaded to YouTube, and two, that they understand how to issue takedowns because they've now issued all of these takedowns. But what YouTube is saying is, well, that's dishonest conduct. And one of two things has happened. It's another one of two. Which is either when this company and their agents were uploading content to these unofficial anonymous YouTube channels, well, when you upload content to a YouTube channel, there are terms and conditions that nobody reads where you say, I have the rights to upload this content. So either they were fraudulently accepting those terms and conditions and then uploading the content, or when they issued the takedowns, there wasn't any copyright infringement because it was their content. But YouTube was basically saying, you were either lying when you uploaded the content or you were lying when you issued the takedowns. Either way, you're liars. Liars don't deserve access to Content ID. And the fact that you've behaved in such a bad way is proof as to why we have to vet people before we give them access to our super powerful rights management tools.
So that's all fun. As we record, it remains to be seen how Schneider and Pirate Monitor respond to YouTube's counterclaim. But either way, the grassroots music community is likely to continue calling for widespread access to YouTube's Content ID system. And YouTube is going to continue not giving it to them, I would guess. Unless somehow this lawsuit is successful, which, I don't know, I think YouTube is probably going to win this one. But we'll see. Maybe this is something else we'll come back to on a future episode. But that's it for this episode of Setlist. Do remember to subscribe, rate, and review all those things. Any number of them. Or one of two? No, there were three. One of three, or two of three, or all of them. Do one of them.
You don't actually have to do that. But Andy would like
you
to.
No, I mean, you don't have to do any of them. But you should. I mean, you listen this far, you owe us. The other thing you could do is email us. You could send us a picture that you drew or something relevant to the show to setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.